We are gathered here today,
this glorious day of October 19th, 1983, to witness the joining of two lives.
I'm only marrying you for the money.
What?
This is the marriage celebration of two people who are dear and special to you.
I thought you loved me.
You said there'd be a bigger crowd.
The decision to marry is not entered into lightly, but undertaken with great consideration and respect for the other person and oneself.
But all my friends and family are here.
All three of them.
The bride and groom must remain silent during the ceremony.
Hey, bud, do you want a tip?
A cheapskate to the end.
And he has the audacity to call himself a justice.
You have vowed to be loyal and loving toward each other.
Let me guess. A honeymoon dinner at Gino's Hamburgers.
May you keep these vows, which you have made here today.
What do you have against Dom DeLuise?
May you comfort each other. Share each other's joys.
If you want to rub my magic lamp, Bobby Beefcake, you'll have to do better than Gino's genie.
Console each other during times of trouble.
Beefcake!
And help each other as husband and wife. May you encourage each other in whatever you set out to achieve.
For this, I gave up my PhD.
Okay, so I'm here once again with the marvelous T.C. Boyle, who is most recently the author of San Miguel. Tom, how are you doing?
I'm still alive, and I think that's a very positive sign, especially at this hour in the morning, Ed.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I'm still alive, too, especially since you're
also... Congratulations.
Yes. How alive will we be? That's the great question in life. So, actually, I found this Pictures to the Editor article from Life. I thought that you were just sort of making this up, this whole Swiss Family Lester thing, but lo and behold, I found this, and I'm sure you probably found this when you had the Life reporter show up in your book, and this leads me to wonder, because I was surprised by how skimpy this article was. I mean, I look at these photos, and there's plenty of information there for a writer of your sort to draw and infer and so forth. So this leads me to wonder, you know, how much research do you need for something along these lines? Is it helpful to not have as many details or to just have, like, say, a picture like this? Or
yeah, I wonder. That's a great question, Ed. The first section of the book about the Waters family allowed me a little more freedom to invent because the diary from which I was working was 50 pages or less, very fragmentary, and only took up a six-month period. With the Lesters, since they were very well known and were featured in Life magazine and on radio shows and all across the country, it was a little more difficult because I didn't want to violate the actual events of history. But I think the two stories, in my mind anyway, blended fairly well.
Mm-hmm. So if you have to go ahead and abide by the rules of history, as a fiction writer, you have to invent. I mean, does this sort of get in the way? I mean,
yes. I mean, this is a question with any of the historical novels I've written, and I've written many, many historical novels and stories too. You don't have to abide. You can do, for instance, what Philip Roth did in The Plot Against America.
Exactly.
You can change anything. There are no rules whatsoever. You can have aliens come in the middle of a realistic story. Usually, when I'm giving you historical elements, I love the true story so much that I want to give it to you. And usually, it's so bizarre. Like, for instance, Stanley McCormick from Riven Rock, or, you know, Alfred Kinsey, or even Frank Lloyd Wright, the people I've written about. In this case, though, I was trying, as you know, for something totally different, and as a companion piece to When the Killing's Done, to give a more of a atmospheric, moody, quotidian kind of approach to what it might have been like to be someone living on this island solely.
Yes, but then you have situations like constant descriptions of the wind, which are often, you know, there's a lot of wind in this book. This leads me to ask you, like, you know, well, what do you do to keep that original? I know you are devoted to original prose, original description, and not wanting to repeat yourself. What do you do to keep that fresh?
Oh, shucks, Ed. I'm just flying by the seat of my pants. Everything works organically. And if it's windy, it's windy. You know, the book begins, for those who don't know, with a series of very short chapters. This is a naturalistic book about people living on an island. And each one introduces a new element. And one of those elements is the fog, for instance.
Yes.
One is the wind. Many of them describe elements of the house, arriving at the house, the kitchen, the bedroom. It's a way of my going deep inside these characters to imagine what it would have been like to live apart from everyone. I mean, this is what a fantasy that so many of us have. I mean, it's why the Lesters were famous in their day.
Yeah.
Simply for living apart from the entire world on this island in sole possession of it during the Depression, when everybody else was lined up on the streets looking for a job.
Yes. What about, you know, did you make any visits to San Miguel? I know you did that for Anacapa for the last book. You know, did you take in the terrain to know how to write about it, especially when there are really no remnants of the homes, the domiciles, or even the sheep that actually exist there?
Indeed, yes, Ed. I made a single trip to San Miguel. Now, I made many, many trips, yeah, of course, to Santa Cruz and Anacapa, which were the setting of the previous book.
Yeah.
As you know from having read San Miguel, this island is the farthest out and the most buffeted by the weather because of the currents. It's not protected by Point Conception. It sits right off of it. So it's getting everything coming down from the northern current from San Francisco, rumbling with the southern current coming up from Los Angeles and San Diego and spinning around in the Santa Barbara Channel. So it's very, very rough seas. I'm told that I write very well about the sea, particularly in When the Killing's Done, which opens with a shipwreck,
yes,
as you remember. But I'm not a good sailor, and my stomach doesn't like being at sea, especially in rough seas. Now, it's an hour and a half across to Santa Cruz in rough seas, but it's 4 hours to San Miguel. And once you get there, you must stay in a campground for several days before the boat will come back to pick you up.
Yeah.
I used a very, very simple stratagem to avoid this. I flew out.
Uh-huh.
I flew out with the ranger, who is the sole person who lives there in the sole building on the island.
Well, that's not exactly cricket if you want to mimic the experience.
Well, of course. I have had the experience of going across the channel many, many times.
Yeah.
And I've
never... But those extra hours, Tom.
It's true. I never actually hung my head over and vomited, but I've been, you know, close on several occasions. I should say, too, when I went to visit the ranger, I brought my son with me. Mm-hmm. I brought Marla Daly, the local historian who turned me on to all of this and published these diaries.
Yes.
And it was wonderful because the ranger himself is an historian of the place, and so is she. So I got to spend a full day with them looking at the rafters that were left in the ground of the old Lester house. There's just a few remnants left, a little midden of cans and stuff. And to really get a sense of all of these places I had read about and the distances and to walk all the trails. But most intrigued me was, as you fly in, the beaches there, you've seen it probably on Walt Disney and Discovery Channel, is a huge breeding ground for the elephant seal.
Mm-hmm.
And you see them, hundreds of them, lying below you like giant inflated sausages. And as soon as I got off the plane, I said to Ian, look, maybe I should be talking to Fish and Game instead of you, but is it a violation if I mate with one of the sea elephants? And he didn't miss a beat. He said, you know, that's a violation on every possible grounds.
How long did the ranger live there? I mean, you know, did you get to know him fairly well to kind of get a sense of just...
Well, I spent a day with him, a day and a night with him. He has to retire. He's only like 50 or something, but they rotate them out, and I think he has to retire soon. But he's been there for some years,
uh-huh,
and he's not there permanently. I mean, he has relief. I mean,
oh, I see.
Because, you know, even people who like solitude might go a little nuts out there.
Yeah, well, as you depict in your book.
A further statistic, in Santa Cruz Island, the big one, four times bigger than Manhattan, right across from Santa Barbara, you can see it right there, there is a public campground, and you can take this boat out and you can camp there. And I was told by the ranger there that some days, like a July 4th weekend, there might be as many as 300 people camping in that campground.
Mm-hmm.
On San Miguel, there are 300 campers per year.
Yeah.
So it's pretty remote.
It is a park, I understand.
It's part of the National Park, yeah. All the Channel Islands are, with the exception of Catalina.
Yeah. So if the ranger gets rotated out, and if you were only relying upon a 50-page diary or, you know, scraps, or in the case of the third part, considerable media attention, although that's accentuated by the fact that suddenly they had electricity, suddenly they had radio and so forth. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, what do you do to mimic that experience of being trapped on an island? I mean, you know, do you go ahead and spend a week eating nothing but lamb? I mean, how does this go?
I'm just using my imagination, yeah. Of course. Again, in this one, as a companion piece for When the Killing's Done, which is so vibrant and wild and deals with a current ethical concern about how we treat animals and who has the right to it and who owns the turf, here I wanted something much more muted to give a kind of experience of what it must have been like, because this is a fantasy of everybody. One of the memoirs, the one by Elizabeth Lester, is called The King of San Miguel.
Yes.
Herbie was the king. Who else is the king? It's just him, his wife, and two kids.
Who wants to be the king?
That's another question. Who wants to be the king? And I think, too, what intrigued me about the first diary, Marantha, and then the Lester book, is that there were these tremendous correspondences between the two families who were in sole possession of this, one in the 1880s and the other in the 1930s. Here are men who have a vision and really don't take into consideration the cost on their wives. I think it's particularly true in the first one, Marantha's story. You know, here was a woman, upper middle class, living in an apartment in San Francisco, convinced by her husband to buy in to this sheep ranch, to buy essentially this island and live there, and of course they make their living in the most essential way. They shear the sheep and sell the wool. What could be simpler? A life in nature. But everyone isn't suited for that.
Why do you think that, well, in the first instance, they wanted to lay down their last $10,000 on this particular capitalist adventure?
He did,
yes.
He did. And she had the money from her first, the late husband.
Yes. I mean, it can't just be your typical sort of greed or avarice or lust for wealth and so forth, or is it?
I think both of the men in the book, Captain Waters was a Civil War veteran, and Herbie was a World War I veteran. Both, I think, had problems with fitting into society after their war experiences, and I think they had a dream of being a part. Of course, I've written about this many, many times, as you know. I mean, Drop City, the idea of the Back to the Earth movement, dropping out, going and making your own utopian society somewhere. And this reduces it just to the utopian society of one single family.
Yeah. It's interesting, in all the novels that you have brought up from the past, you have not brought up East is East, which is also, of course, set on an island. I'm wondering how much the shadow of that hung over the writing of San Miguel. I mean, you have a situation with Jimmy where there's this kind of muted racism going on, or at least it's underplayed, where it's a lot more pronounced in East is East.
Yeah.
And then when we have this issue later on with Herb and the Japanese men who came onto the island, I couldn't help but think, oh, well, wait a minute, this is sort of comparable to East is East. I mean, you know,
you're
what
a wonderful
you
reader, well, and I love these connections. I think part of the joy of having a large corpus of work is that faithful readers, or readers who dig what you're doing and read it all, get these correspondences. But of course, I'm always trying for a different approach.
Yeah.
East is East is a rock'em sock'em flat-out satire, which also, I think, has some heart to it and discusses questions of racism, but also is, as you point out, set on an island off the coast of Georgia.
Yes.
I love these little correspondences. Both Japanese and Chinese fishermen often came to these islands. In the case of actual history, it was a Japanese who stole Herbie's rifle.
Yes.
But for my purposes, I wanted it to be Japanese, not only because I love the culture, and I've used Japanese figures in many, many books, including East is East, but because what ultimately was to happen, both in the novel and in real life, is that the attack on Pearl Harbor would spell the doom of this domestic tranquility on the island.
But aren't you hamstrung by the fact that you have explored people who live on an island before in East is East? I mean, even if you go ahead and mute the irony, as you did in this particular book, does this kind of limit what you're supposed to do, or do you work well within those limitations? Like, you have in the first book, East is East, you know, literally an artistic colony. In this, you have basically a place that's completely starved of art. Thin records on the shelves, very few books and so forth. I mean, we don't really see art until there's a little bit of a trade going on later in the book.
So you wonder what the value of culture is.
Exactly.
You know, and contrasting the two. I like this.
Well,
this
there's that, but there's also, you know, I mean, what obligation do you have not to repeat yourself? I mean, what do you do to face the inevitability of, like, okay, I've got people on the island, I've got my voice, I'm going to go ahead and probably do similar things, but I don't want to because I'm Tom Boyle and I have to go ahead and write every book original.
Yeah, Ed, I mean, it's a great question, which really didn't occur to me very much. I suppose in the back of my head when I'm selecting a topic, I'm thinking how it fits in with my obsessions, which we've talked about, you know, this American quest for a utopia, the need for independence from everybody else, living in nature, living as a part of nature, being an animal in nature. And so these are the thoughts in the back of my mind, not so much how I could contrast this book with East is East. They're just utterly different books written in utterly different periods,
yeah,
with different emphases, although, as you point out, there are, of course, the ghost of one book informs the other. But again, I think it's a question of approach, too. I have written stories in a realist mode, sans irony.
Yes.
The one most recently in The New Yorker.
Yes, that's right.
Burnham Wood, which will, by the way, conclude next year's T.C. Boyle Stories 2,
mm-hmm,
the second volume of the collective works. I wanted to see how it would work in a larger narrative, and perhaps I was influenced, too, by the tone of these narratives by the two women. And it just seemed natural to go in this direction. I will say this, though. It gave me some difficulty because I'm playing in a field in which I've never had much experience, that is, a straightforward, realistic piece. I wanted to see if I could do that. And at first, I thought that I would have to have the point of view of the men, especially because of what happens at the end.
Yes.
And I actually began in that way. I'd gotten several chapters in, uh-huh, and began a chapter from the point of view of Captain Waters.
You alluded to this last time, that it,
right,
was men initially.
Right.
Again, you go back to the woman yet again.
Right, yes. And I realized that it wasn't as powerful or interior as I had wanted. And I eliminated that. And the book then seemed to pick up its pace and to kind of reveal itself to me.
Why do you think it didn't work with men? I'm curious.
I don't know. Again, every book is utterly different.
Why did the women blossom to life more than the men did? Why were the men, were they too predictable for you, or were the women just more interesting and having to deal with them?
No, I think because I had just done something similar in When the Killing's Done, where you have two antagonists, or primarily two antagonists, a man and a woman, and we are in both of their minds. I'd done the same thing in Talk Talk as well.
Yeah.
And I felt I just wanted to do something different from that. And I guess this gave me the key to it. It was very difficult at first to try to do this because it's not exactly my natural mode.
Yeah.
And I felt that by eliminating the men, it was different for me, and it gave me the key to make this thing work.
Uh-huh. So in order to remove irony from your voice, you had to actually focus on something of comfort or something familiar, something that you were good at, which is like writing about women. Is that safe to say?
Maybe. But, you know, we have to go back to the beginning of my career. When my wife would always complain that my women characters were pretty thin. I also pointed out to her, well, so were my male characters, because at the beginning I didn't care about character. I cared about design and idea and language and, you know.
Yeah.
But over the years, of course, writing all these stories and novels, I've begun to use character more. I didn't really think much of character in the past. And that's great. I think that's another tool to make a more complete kind of story. And so I had made a point of trying to write from a woman's perspective, first in East is East with Ruth Dershowitz, but then also with Dana Halter in Talk Talk, and then the three women in Frank Lloyd Wright's book, The Women, and now this one. So I'm just trying to stretch my wings a little bit and see what I can do.
When did you first know, since we're on the subject, that character was really the mode for you, perhaps more than language in many instances? What book was that?
Well, I don't know.
Yeah, no.
To write a novel,
roughly?
I think Water Music. to write an, even though it's very satirical and a crazy romp, I think to write a novel you have to have characters that grow and sustain themselves, or the reader will not, or the writer himself will not be interested in them.
Yeah.
So I think it's through the process of writing novels rather than just short stories. And you know, the new book for next year, T.C. Boyle Stories 2, it collects all the stories since T.C. Boyle Stories in 98, including an entire new volume of 14 stories called The Death in Kitchewak. And this one that we just saw in The New Yorker will conclude that volume. And I have a foreword, you know, meditating on these questions that we're asking now about my career and how the stories may have changed. And I think probably the stories since 98, more or less, are more character-oriented than the ones that came before. But there, of course, there are exceptions. You could mix and match them. But I think, yeah, I hope I've grown into it. And I hope that I continue to grow into doing other things that I haven't explored before.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about, you know, you referred to East is East as a ghost. I mean, does it pain you to revisit material, even material as late as 98, for rehashing in this collection?
I don't look backward at all. As you know, we've talked about this before. John Updike, one of my great heroes, in his first volume of collected stories, wrote a foreword and said that he had made adjustments in these stories. I will not make any adjustments. I want them to be as they were in their period as a matter of historical interest.
Sure.
And I don't want to rewrite them. I'm always looking for what will come next. That's the excitement of being an artist, is you don't know what the next thing will be. You know, This Monkey My Back, the little essay about writing that I have on my website. I'm trying to convey the thrill of what it is to make something. So I don't really look back, and I didn't really look back to At East is East. I don't reread my old work.
But, of course, now you have this whole ransom situation, right? So, you know, what obligation do you have to the legacy, or are you going to let just other people kind of flitter through that?
You're referring to the fact that I sold my archive to
the ransom. Or was that just a great way of cleaning the house?
Both. Yeah. It's a way of getting some money, for one thing, and also of cleaning the house. I mean, I began to get worried about this archive I'd saved all my life. I'm very precise, by the way, about that. You know, everything is in folders, labeled, perfect. I was praised by the curators for having a clean archive. That is, no blood stains, no marinara sauce, no dead roaches, you know. The firestorms of the last few years in Santa Barbara just are terrifying. And, you know, to lose this Frank Lloyd Wright house would be devastating.
Yeah.
But to lose the archive as well would be even worse. So that is what motivated me finally to get these manuscripts out of the house and into the archives for whoever might care. And, you know, it's always hard to give up elements of your past.
Yeah.
But in fact, Ed, I never opened any of those boxes or ever looked at it anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
well, now it creates a less incentive to actually go ahead and revisit it, even if you had that incentive in the first place.
I suppose so, but already, you know, I haven't been very productive since then.
Yeah.
And I have a new archive building.
I see. So any kind of new work you do is just going to be sent to ransom and it's going to take care of it? Or how does it work?
I would keep it, and I would think maybe in 10 years or so when there's enough accumulated, but I would like them to have it all, of course, to be in one place.
Okay. While I'm on the subject of ransom, I wanted to ask, were there any particular letters or things that you did not give ransom that you were going to burn like Kafka upon your desk?
I'm pretty oblivious to things like this, and I really don't care what I would give them every single scrap of everything. However, Frau Boyle became involved at the last minute when the woman from Ransom, and she saw the stuff going out the door, and the very first correspondence file from the 70s, there was a letter that she had written me when we were lovers, and that letter was immediately torn up and thrown in the fireplace by her, and I thought that was wrong.
Wow.
But
I
don't know what, truly, I don't know what's in the files.
Wow.
I have no idea what's in the files. I gave them everything, but then they gave some stuff back because then they were financial things. Mm-hmm. For instance, with my agent.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want anyone now to look and say, well, Boyle got such and such for this novel. Why didn't so-and-so get it, too, and embarrass anybody? So they did give back any kind of financial disclosures or things with my social security number on them. But basically, I didn't look at it at all. I just had the woman come in, pack it up, and take it.
Yes.
I mean, tons of stuff. And you know what else is interesting? Here we live in this media age.
Yeah.
And what is fascinating to me is to see writers of the past on TV or hear their voice on the radio. I once saw a clip of an old film of George Bernard Shaw.
Yes.
A skinny, crazy old man dancing around on the stage and singing and carrying on. I love that. But but Ransom wants paper. They want actual paper. They want a document. They want a thing. So they did not take a lot of the audiovisual stuff. I mean, imagine if we had a trove of Dickens, you know, on Letterman Show and all of this.
Yeah.
So there are thousands of things I have that are still there. Now, I don't know whether they'll take them next time around or not, but I would think that that would be as fascinating in some ways as the manuscripts themselves.
Well, especially if you're dealing with formats that are now more difficult to play, that need to be transferred over, that need to be digitized and so forth. I mean, maybe they didn't take it because they knew that there's like a bunch of digital costs involved or something.
No, I think they didn't take it because it's too hard.
Yeah.
This was their first dip into it.
I see.
Yeah, I think they will eventually have all of that stuff. I think that would be, if society exists in 100 years, which of course it won't, but if it did, if there's some miracle, we have a society
in
100 years.
That's an optimistic
view. Yes, thank you. It would be so interesting to see any of our contemporary writers whom we love to have somebody be able to see them in action. You know, like the disastrous Kerouac appearance on the Buckley show.
Yes, yes.
It's so sad and so telling in many ways and so embarrassing, but it's real. You see who they really were. I love that stuff.
Yeah. No, I mean, I love it too, but on the other hand, one might also make the argument that, well, is this really pertinent or germane to the writer?
Right.
You know,
of course,
you know, you're I guess going to have to deal with this too, but or you'd be not.
You're absolutely
care.
Right.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. The work is all that matters. But whenever we love a band or a movie or a book, we want to know who made it, and it's a kind of desire for gossip, I suppose. I love literary biography, particularly current figures, you know, like the Carol Sklenico biography of Ray Carver or Blake Bailey's biography of Cheever and Yeats. I love to read them because I just want to see the struggle. I love the parts before they made it, you know?
Yeah.
Because we know they made it. We love their work. Let's see who they were. And it, of course, that might be artificial too, but it's just kind of thrilling for me as a fan to be able to read about it.
But I'm sure you've read Alan Hollinghurst's The Strangest Child, his last book, which, you really should. It actually raises a very interesting question about the futility of literary biography as it goes into the past and digs up this obscure
Is it a novel?
It's a novel, yes. And it takes place over the course
What's
of...
What's the title?
It's The Stranger's Child. It's really good.
Okay.
Beautiful language,
okay.
As you get from Hollinghurst. And it really sort of shows that really it ultimately doesn't matter. It's really good. I just got paperback.
Okay.
So,
would you jot it down for me before we leave?
I totally will. So anyway, I want to go back to San Miguel. You know, we've talked before about your tendency to play joyful God towards your characters. I read this book, and I it was almost like the obverse experience, because in this case it seemed to me that your characters didn't want to go to the island and you had to actually go ahead and deliver them there, and there was a certain kind of pleasure, I suppose, that the reader gets in seeing the author have to contend with the inevitability of placing these characters on the island. I think of a chapter where in the train station where you have poor Edith, who is trying to get away but of course has to go back to the island. I'm wondering, you know, if there was any kind of torment you felt at having to return to this really wretched place. And
yeah, of course. And you know, the book could have gone outside the island
because of what
happened to Edith in later life, but I didn't want that. I wanted to keep it confined. I wanted you to be on the island having a miserable, wind-blown, foggy experience with no escape. Because on the one hand, it is liberating to be your own king of your own turf and be apart from the continent. But on the other, then you have to deal with all these other questions of loneliness and despair and the violence of nature and how our best intentions to control nature are almost always thwarted.
On the other hand, you have Herbie saying late in the book, I'd rather shoot myself than see these girls leave the island. So, you know, I don't think this quite answers my question. I know that you're a stubborn man. You know, you had to have become sick of this place at some point, especially since, you know, in order to have some kind of persuasive emotion on the page, you kind of have to tap into your own emotions and of your own feelings of despair.
Okay, so, and
well, unless you have a
All right. I am a nature boy. We've talked about this many times. I love to be apart from society by myself,
yes,
deep in the woods, and I spend a lot of time up in the sequoias doing this. But the longest I've spent up there by myself while writing and having a full day of composing is maybe 2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Then I would come home for a week to civilization, to see other people, to go to the bar and to a play or whatever. So I can have a sense of isolation, and I really appreciate that, but I can escape it as well. So the island, especially in the old days when it was so hard to get there, I mean, it's not easy to get there today, as I've just told you.
Yeah.
Was a kind of prison, as well as a... if you're in solitary confinement... It can be pretty depressing, but
yeah,
on the other hand, you're safe from everybody else. Nobody can get to you. And that was sort of the situation that you get by choosing not simply to live in nature as Thoreau did. He could walk in every day as he did to the Concord to go to the coffee shop and
yes,
read the papers.
Yes.
But on an island where there is no way off, in San Francisco Bay, where you have to go to the prison.
Yeah, Alcatraz, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's surrounded by water. It's an island. You're imprisoned there. You cannot escape. And I
but it's very close to Angel Island as well.
That's true. That's true. It's something that I kept in my mind throughout writing this.
Did you imprison yourself at any point during the writing, aside from the 2 to 3 weeks in your secret nature spot or anything like that?
Only in my mind. I began it and wrote the body of it while I was up on the mountain. When we talked last, I was struggling with the novel,
yeah,
and then I was off on tour, which interrupted it.
Yeah.
As soon as that was over, which would be early May, a year ago, not this past May,
yeah,
I went to the mountain and finished the book within 3 months. And so it was mainly written up there.
Yeah. Did you
in isolation.
Did you find that the only way to really get this book finished or to wrestle with it was really just through isolation? How does that isolation differ from the isolation you usually have in your bunker at home?
Not at all. Huh. Not at all. Huh. No. I mean, it's like writing any other book.
Yeah.
You need
yeah
to clear space for yourself. I use the internet constantly while writing stories and novels to find facts that I need to know. It's a
yeah
wonderful tool. But unlike most, I have iron discipline. No matter how interesting whatever I've just discovered is, I'm looking for a given fact. As soon as I find it, I'm back into the manuscript. So I do try to isolate myself from outside influence when I'm working. Of course, it makes sense. You're opening up your unconscious. You don't want to break that dream. I'm always listening to music while I'm doing it. It's there in the background. It's comforting. It's rhythmic. It's giving me life, and it's informing me, but it's not distracting me.
Yeah. It's interesting that you would write this book now, while America is in a questionable financial and political state. And I've actually seen a couple of other books come out where writers who typically have that sort of joyful verve in their prose are now sort of committing themselves to, okay, how depressing or how serious can I be? There's another writer I talked to early in the year, Brian Francis Slattery, who did this with Lost Everything, and he told me how he was just saturating his mind on the world's most depressing films in order to see if he can actually hit that place. Do you think, well, there's a couple of questions here that come to mind. One, you know, what provoked you, I suppose, to really wanting to visit this particular emotional place? And was it possibly related to a reaction to what's going on? And there was another question I had, but I think we'll
okay, well, yeah, you know, we do have the depression going on,
yes,
during this second part of the book. And in the first part of the book, too, Captain Waters is a man who wanted to make some money.
Yeah.
And in fact, he did make
yeah
money off this wool-growing operation. I don't know as to whether I want to be depressing. One could say that in my most joyful and hilarious books, of course, the worldview is pretty depressing, no matter what. You know, A Friend of the Earth, for instance. Maybe I would hate to say that my joy in life has been muted by the inevitable end of life and by the destruction of everything that we love by our species, which has now grown to 7 billion, as Alma Boyd Takasui keeps saying in When the Killing's Done. I wouldn't want to go there, but maybe I have a more muted view of things. At my advanced age, you know, I will be 87 on my next birthday.
I know, you're looking very well for your
Thank
age.
Thank you.
Yeah. But I mean, you know...
By the way, it's because I have a clean conscience.
Yeah.
By the way, I told this to my doctor. You know, he's looking me over and he asked the usual question, do you sleep well? I said, of course, I sleep well. I have a clean conscience. He didn't miss a beat. He said, either that or you have no scruples.
Yes, certainly. But I'm wondering, though, if the fact that most human beings now in human history live in cities, and we're so comfortable with the amniotic fluid of our civilization. I mean, even I caved
in. And our handheld devices.
I caved in. I got a smartphone actually about a week ago, believe it or not. I've succumbed, and you know, it's been invaluable for journalism, but I have to be very careful because there's that addictive road.
Oh, Jesus,
yes. Oh, well, I know. Well, it's
I resent the machine's power over us, and one thing I like to broadcast to the world in my modest way, extremely modest way, is that there is a liberation in nature and in contemplative time to read a book and disconnect for a while. Yeah, I'm staring into a screen for hours every day. I'm running my business by email. But my phone is shut off. Astonishingly, I only use it when I need to call somebody.
And I
wonder about everyone in cities having no experience of nature or even of quiet time. The noise, the constant electronic noise, it's great, it's fun, hallelujah, you know, you don't have to stare at the wall, you can play a video game or search the internet on your handheld device. Okay, great.
It's not just that, though. I would talk by Wall Street, the one-year anniversary, I was able to take pictures of people being arrested and document that.
Yeah, okay. No,
so, you know,
there
are valuable tools for it. It's not just
absolutely.
You know, shits and giggles.
No, absolutely. But I just wonder if, of course, I am a Luddite. I just wonder if the experience of nature is completely lost to most people.
Yeah.
How can you want to preserve nature if you've never had any experience of it?
Sure.
To me, since I grew up in Westchester, like Huckleberry Finn running through the woods as a boy, it's very important for me to be away from everybody. I like to look at a sky that's dark at night instead of yellow. I would never hike or jog or anything with earplugs. I want to hear, smell, feel, taste, etc., what's going on around me. But most people don't have any knowledge of this. And so, why would they care whether we drill in the Arctic Preserve or not?
Do you think, though, that fiction, by presenting a
yes.
wild and feral...
Yes.
Well, of course it does. But, I mean, you know, is this really the way that fiction can... you know, present its cards to the table, sort of not forcing people, but inviting people into this natural existence in a way that, say, you know, journalism or smartphones
yes.
or whatever.
Yes, know. Absolutely. Yeah. I was touched by the fact that so many biologists picked up When the Killing's Done.
Yeah.
And many said to me, this is what we need. We can write essays and give speeches forever and people tune us out. But if you can get them emotionally and present an issue in a work of art in an emotional way without prejudice, then people can begin to understand and appreciate what the problem is. The tortilla curtain about illegal immigration, it's the same thing. I'm not presenting solutions. I'm not running for office. I'm not giving speeches. I'm not an advocate. I'm an artist. I'm trying to explore something for my own purposes. And yes, you look at my books, you see what my obsessions are, you see how worried I am about things and how concerned
sure.
I am about the environment, for instance. Racism, mistreatment of the creatures of the world, all of this. But I don't think you can deliver it as a polemic. People turn off. So yes, art can bring you there. Art can... you can read San Miguel and have never been outside your apartment. And I hope that you can have a feeling for what it might like be like if you were the one to choose to be apart from everyone else.
But it's still a simulation. Is the hope to perhaps get people outside of their apartments? I mean, even in California, where they're shutting down all these marvelous places and letting them rot, including the Jack London Museum, which has been disappointing to watch because that's my home state, right? So it's been... is this really going to be enough? Will simulation basically be all that we have in order to know about this aspect of human existence?
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. As I've said many times, we now have virtual reality just in time because real reality is going fast.
Speaking of simulation, actually, I wanted to ask you, you do know that Mutiny on the Bounty, the 1935 film, was shot at San Miguel Island. I was wondering why you didn't include
it. I wanted to work some of that in. Of course, if it were a comic novel, I certainly would have worked that in. There's a lot of material I did not use. Fascinating material from the early film period as well.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you opt for the National Weather Service aspect of how the island was transformed as opposed to, say, the film people coming in. And I'm wondering, was this an effort on your part to tether it to some tangible reality? Was this sort of a way to pay greater respect to the geography and so forth, or to the readership who needs this kind of perspective we're talking about? Or?
I wanted to keep it very hermetic, to live through these people and wonder what it is like day-to-day existence in solitary. So I didn't want to bring in a lot of outside influences. Yes, you have chapters in which the Japanese sailor pops up. There were people who would come to the island occasionally, fishermen, they'd see boats go by. It was a very small society. But essentially, it was just two families locked together. And the first story, the Marantha story, you know, it's almost like a stage play. Eugene O'Neill could have written this. I mean, you've got the wife with consumption. You've got the bellicose, pot-bellied Civil War veteran trying to manipulate her and make his fortune. You've got the boy, Jimmy, who no one knows anything about him except from his mention in these diaries, who, in my telling, is an orphan who is just got nothing else to do and is a ranch hand. And you've got this guy, Adolf, who is the Confederate of Captain Waters, and then you've got this young girl, not quite 15 when she is taken out of school, a girl with ambitions to be a stage actress and a musician, and she's dragged out here to live in nature, but harsh nature, a place that is very unforgiving. It's not Mutiny on the Bounty, it's not a paradise, it's not the South Sea Islands. Despite the fact that Captain Waters had portrayed it this way,
yes,
it's a miserable, very cold, windy, foggy, violent place.
Yeah. Well, one of the interesting sexual material that actually occurs during this book, I mean, we were saying earlier about, well, does an island drive people mad, or does a miserable place drive people mad, or is it something that's just embedded within us, that take away our civilization and you'll be... You know, I suppose the equivalent of the monsters do on Maple Street, except if you actually have it on the island, then people give in to their worst impulses. You know, do you really think that most human beings would do what these characters do, even with the historical verification here?
One of my favorite books of all time is Golding's Lord of the Flies.
Yeah.
And he explored this brilliantly and talked about society. I'm not really doing that in this book. These are families. These are people... in the most stripped down society there can possibly be. And yet there is sexuality in the book. I hadn't even really thought of it. One interviewer mentioned it to me, and then I began to think about Edith in particular.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking, too, about when our sexuality is burgeoning, when we're young, when we are adolescent. And I imagined what it must have been like for her with only one possibility.
Yeah.
That is the boy, Jimmy.
Yeah, yeah. Elise's Francophilia, I wanted to actually ask you about that. It seems to me that there is at least some need for romance even in a dismal place. The idea, the joke I suppose here is that you can go ahead and cleave to language as a way to find some passion or meaning in something that you don't particularly care for. And I'm wondering about that because it almost, you know...
And civilization.
Yes, and civilization.
After all, she was a librarian for the New York City Public Library, had grown up in Westchester in a fairly well-to-do family.
Yeah.
She was 38 when she married. This is in 1930. I mean, a spinster would have been 22 would have been a spinster by
yes.
then, you know?
Yes.
And it's quite an amazing story, her actual story of being swept off her feet by this dynamic guy, Herbie, who, like Captain Waters, had a vision of getting away from everybody, you know, damaged by the war, wanting independence, wanting to assert himself, wanting the old, you go back to budding prospects, the old American dream of making it, having a scheme and making it. And unlike Marantha, she was willing and she was in love.
Yes.
And they had a pretty good life. The problem was outside forces, World War II, and Herbie's mental instability.
Did her more hopeful story keep you going through the two bleaker ones, or?
I don't know. I did realize that they would contrast.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So, the contrast, I mean, you know...
I have no obligation to make the reader feel, uplifted. But, it just happens that way.
But you're going ahead and saying, I'm not taking out the knives, I'm not committing myself to humor... You know, that you're basically going into this thing and you're saying, I have to filter myself and concentrate. And even with an imposing ironclad discipline, I mean, there has to be the temptation there to go ahead and be
the
a
wickedness.
Little scabrous and everything. And so,
but,
you know...
But again, I tried to do something different. And I'll give you the scoop on this. If I weren't on tour right now, I would be beginning the next novel.
Yeah.
And the next novel, in contrast to this one, because, you know, I don't want people to pin me down, is going to be your basic hairy-chested man's novel.
You claim that this one would be it.
Well, this one didn't quite make it there yet.
Yeah, yeah.
And it will have to do with, it'll be a contemporary story having to do with our propensity for violence, and it will also have a lot of nature in it.
Yeah. What do you do when you deviate from the template a bit? I mean, you know, how do you accept deviation, the natural deviation that comes whenever you write a novel, when you have a historical record that you're also contending with? There's a way of getting you to answer my question, the question I asked you earlier,
right.
You didn't quite answer, so.
It's a question of valence. Again, there is a little disclaimer that I wrote for Water Music, my first novel. At the suggestion of my editor at the time, Peter Davison, he said, you know, we don't want a lot of letters from the British Historical Society about inaccuracies here. And I'd like to include that disclaimer that, yes, I love the history, and I'm presenting it to you, as I said earlier, because it fascinates me. I find these odd stories. Stanley McCormick of Riven Rock, for instance, how bizarre this was. This is the actual true story. And so I want to present it because I love this history. And that does constrain you to a degree. But what lights me up, as in this novel, San Miguel, is to inhabit the characters and to dramatize the events. I do this with contemporary stories, too, like The Lie, for instance, or Chicxulub. These are stories that are read about in the newspaper. It could be a paragraph, but, a guy told a lie, I read about it in the paper, that he didn't want to go to work, so he said that his baby had died.
Yeah.
You know, it's a paragraph.
Yeah.
So I'm taking this as a template, but I then inhabit him. What would be the ramifications of this? And again, this is the difference between journalism and fiction. In journalism, you can have a wonderful story, but the journalist feels an obligation, or should, or most do, to present it as truthfully as possible. My obligation is to myself, but in my own eyes, I see it as dramatizing it. It's point of view.
Yeah. Have you felt anything akin to a journalistic impulse at all, or
no?
No.
No. I've told you this before.
Yeah.
You know, I'm very single-minded, and I love the idea of art and finding out what's next. So, I don't look back. I don't do anything else. I don't want to write book reviews. I don't want to write essays or speeches. I just want to do what I'm doing in my own way.
Well, on that note, seems a good place to end. Tom, thanks very much. It was a pleasure to chat yet again.
As always, my dear fellow.
All right.